a life in itself is not the goal. The goal surpasses life. The life is just an opportunity to realize the goal. The goal is hidden deep in life, but you cannot find it on the surface. You will have to penetrate to the very center. The life is like a seed. In itself it is not enough. You will have to work hard so the seed sprouts, becomes a tree and comes to bloom. This is one of the most fundamental things to remember, that man has to surpass himself, that life has to transcend itself. If you don't understand this, then you will be lost into the means and you will forget the end. That's what happens ordinarily. We become too attached with life and we forget that life was just an opportunity to understand something which is deeper than life, higher than life, superior, far superior than life. If you get too much obsessed with life itself, it is as if somebody was sent to the university and he became too much attached with the university. And he cannot leave it. And he cannot even conceive of leaving it. The university is there just to educate you for something greater. For the universe, the university is to prepare you. That's why we call it the university. It itself is not the universe, just a preparation. In the East, a life is just like an university, a discipline, a training for something far beyond it. If you become too much attached with life, then you will be coming again and again back every year to the university. Then it is futile, pointless. A university has to be renounced one day. It is just a preparation. And if the preparation becomes endless, then it becomes a burden. That is what has happened to many people. They take life as the goal. Then they go on preparing, they go on preparing endlessly. They never go on the journey, they simply prepare for the journey. And if their life becomes an impotent gesture, no wonder. It is natural, it has to be so. Just think about yourself, always consulting timetables, always getting ready to leave, always inquiring the tourist office and never leaving, never going anywhere. You will go mad. Nothing is wrong with life itself, but if your attitude is this, that life is an end unto itself, then you will be in trouble. Then your whole life will become meaningless. The meaning is there, but the meaning is transcendental to it. The meaning is there, but you will have to penetrate to that core where it is revealed. To think life as the goal is to remain on the periphery. That periphery Buddha calls the wheel. The symbol of the wheel is very significant and has to be understood. The periphery Buddha calls the wheel, it goes on moving. You can watch a bullock cart moving the wheels move. They move on something which is unmoving. The center remains unmoving. The hub remains unmoving. On an unmoving hub, the wheel goes on moving. If you only look at the wheels, you will be looking at the temporal. If you become capable of looking at the hub, you will be able to penetrate the eternal. If you only look at the periphery, you will be watching the accidental. If you become capable of reaching to the center, to the hub, you will be able to know the essential. And unless you come to know the essential, you will be repeating the same thing again and again and again. The world is called the wheel because things go on repeating itself again and again. And you become by and by repetitive. And the more you repeat yourself, the more you are bored. The more you are bored, the more dull and stupid you become. You lose intelligence. You lose freshness. You lose awareness. You become a robot, a mechanical thing. Watch people around you. They have become a robot. They just go on doing the same thing again and again. Every morning, every evening. They go on moving in the same rut. And of course, they look dead. There is no spark. In your eyes, in their eyes, you cannot find any ray of light. Buddha calls this continuous repetition of the wheel a sansar. To get out of it, to get out of this rut, is nirvana. Before we enter the sutra, few things have to be understood. Life is the game of the games, the ultimate game. It has tremendous meaning in it. If you take it as a game and you don't become serious about it, if you remain simple, innocent, the game is going to impart many things to you. Sometimes you were a tiger and sometimes you were a rock and sometimes you became a tree and sometimes you became a man. Sometimes you were a small ant and sometimes an elephant. Buddha says, all these are games. You have been playing 1001 games. To know life in every possible way, by playing game after game, the player may experience all the permutations of matter in evolution. That is the goal of life. When you exist like a tree, you know life in one way. Nobody else can know it except the tree. The tree has its own vision. When clouds come in the sky and the sun shines and there is a rainbow, only the tree knows how to feel it. It has a perceptivity of its own. When the breeze passes by, the tree knows how to be soured in it. When a bird starts singing, only the tree knows, only the tree has ears for it, for its music, its melody. The tree has a way to know life, its own way. Only a tree knows that way. A tiger has another way of knowing life. He is playing another game. An ant is playing a totally different game. Millions of games. All these games are like classes of a university. You pass through each class you learn something, then you move into another class. Man is the last point. If you have learned all the lessons of life and the lesson of being a human being, then only you will become capable to move into the very center of life. Then you will be able to know what God is, or Nirvana is. All through these games you have been trying to approach God through many directions, in many ways, in many perceptivities. But the goal is the same, that everybody is trying to know what the truth is. What is the mystery of this life? Why we are here and who I am? And what is this that goes on existing? There is only one way to learn it, and that is the way of existence. But if you just move from one class to another, like a sleepwalker, a somnambulist, unconscious, dragged from one class to another, not moving deliberately and consciously, you will miss. That's how many people arrive at the point of being human beings and they cannot see any God. That simply shows they have missed the lessons. They avoided the lessons. They were in the classes, but they have not got the point. Otherwise, every person who has arrived to the stage of being human must be religious. Being human and being religious must become synonymous. They are not synonymous. Very rarely few people are religious. I don't mean by religious a person who goes to the church every Sunday. I don't mean by religious a person who is Christian, Mohammedan, Hindu, Jain, Buddhist. I don't mean by religious that you belong to a religious organization. When I say religious, I mean a person who is aware that life is so full of transcendence, that from everywhere life is overflowing into something bigger than life, that every step is leading you towards God, truth, nirvana, freedom. That whether you know it or not, you are moving towards the ultimate temple. When a person starts feeling it in his very guts, then a person is religious. He may go to the church, he may not go to the church, that is irrelevant. He may call himself a Christian or a Mohammedan or a Hindu, that is irrelevant. He may not call. He may belong to any organization, he may not belong. But he belongs to God. And when I say God, remember, by God I mean that which transcends. That is always ahead of you. You are always coming closer to it, approaching closer and closer and closer, but it always remains ahead of you. God is that omega point which always remains the goal. You come close to it, but you can never possess it. It cannot be ever in your hands. You can drop yourself completely in it. You can merge yourself in it, but still you will know that much remains to know. In fact, the more you know, the more you feel that much remains to know. The more you know, the more you become humble. The mystery is infinite, ineffable. cannot be exhausted. That unexhaustible source, that transcendental source is what I mean by God. And by calling a person religious, I mean who has become alert about the transcendental. When you are alert about the transcendental, your life has a beautiful charm, a grace. Then your life has energy, intelligence. Then your life has a sharpness, a creativity. Then your life has a holy aura to it. By becoming aware of the transcendental, you become part of the transcendental. He has penetrated in your awareness. A ray of light has entered into the dark night of your soul. You are no more alone. And you are no more a stranger into existence. You are deeply rooted in it. This is your home. A religious person is one who feels existence as his home. A religious person is one who feels existence constantly evolving and evolving, going higher and higher towards that ultimate omega point where you disappear, where all limitations disappear, and only infinity is left, only eternity is left. So this game of life has to be played very skillfully. Buddha calls skill upaya. It is his one of the most beautiful words. He says, be skillful. If you are not skillful, you will miss much that is valuable. Be skillful means be aware. Just don't go on dragging yourself half asleep, half awake. Shake yourself into awareness. Bring more awareness into each act of your life, into each step of your being. Then only, with open eyes, you start seeing something which cannot be ordinarily seen when you are asleep, when you are unconscious. Shake all the dust from the eyes. Be skillful and live life consciously. Otherwise, life becomes boring. You feel it. You know how it feels. Sooner or later, everything feels boring. One is bored to death. One goes on living because one is not courageous enough to commit suicide. One goes on living just in the hope that sooner or later one will die. The death is coming. Mullah Nasruddin was going on a world tour. And he was traveling in a ship for the first time. And he was very seasick. The captain came to him and said, "Don't be worried, Nasruddin. I have been working as a captain for 20 years. I have never seen any man die out of seasickness. Don't be worried." Mullah said, "My God, that was my only hope. That I will die. You have taken even that hope. People are living just in the hope that someday or other they are going to die. So they go on saying to themselves, don't lose heart. Death is coming. If you are waiting for death, if you are so bored, then there is no possibility for any encounter with God. The encounter can happen only in radiance, in sharpness, in awareness. But why we get bored? The Buddhist explanation is of tremendous import. Buddha says you have done the same things not only in this life, you have been doing them for millions of lives, hence boredom. You may not remember them, but deep the memory is there. Nothing is lost as far as memory is concerned. There is a reservoir of memory. Buddha calls it alaya vijnana, reservoir of memory. It is exactly what Jung calls the collective unconscious. You carry the body changes, the identity changes, but the bundle of memories goes on jumping from one life to another. And it goes on accumulating, gathering. It goes on becoming bigger and bigger. Nothing is lost as far as memory record is concerned. If you look into yourself, you have the whole record of the existence in you. Because you have been here from the very beginning, if there was any beginning. You have been always here. You are an intrinsic part of this existence. All that has happened to existence has happened to you also. And you carry the record. You may not know it, but you have loved millions of times. Again, falling in love, it is nothing new. It is the very old story. You have done all the things that you are doing. You have been ambitious, you have been greedy, you accumulated wealth, you became very famous, you had prestige and power. This has happened many, many times, millions of times. And you carry deep down in the unconscious the reservoir of the memories. And whatsoever you are doing looks futile, pointless, meaningless. I have heard a newspaper reporter was interviewing Mullah Nasruddin on his 100th birthday. If you had your life to live over, he asked, do you think you would make the same mistakes again? Certainly, said the old Mullah, but I would start a lot sooner. I would start a lot sooner. This is what is happening. Out of mistakes, you only learn how to start them sooner. You don't learn how to drop them. You only learn how to start them sooner and how to do them more efficiently next time. Buddha says, if you can penetrate this reservoir of memories, then you will be really fed up. Then you will see, I have been doing the same thing again and again and again. And then, in that state of awareness, you will start doing something new for the first time. And that will bring a thrill, a fresh air into your being. There are two time concepts in the world. In the West, the linear time concept has been prevalent. Christians, Jews, Mohammedans, they are all offshoots of one Judaic concept of life. They have believed in the linear concept of time. That time is moving in a line. The Eastern concept, the Hindu, the Buddhist, the Jainist concept is different. It is circular. Time is moving in a circle. If time is moving in a line, then things are not repeated again. The line goes on moving. It never comes back to meet and move on the same old track again. If time is thought to be circular, then everything is being repeated. An Eastern concept seems to be more truer. Because every movement is circular. Just watch all the movements. The seasons moving around the year are circular. Again comes the summer. Again. In the same way it moves. The earth moves in a circle. The sun moves in a circle. The stars move in a circle. And now, Albert Einstein has suggested that the whole universe is also moving in a circle. Not only that, Einstein introduced a very strange concept to the physics, and that is the concept of circular space. The whole space is circular. The East has always thought that circle is the natural way of things. They move in circle, and by, they become circular. All movement is circular, then time has also to be circular, because time is nothing but pure movement. If you think about time as circular, then the whole world view changes. Your whole life is also circular, according to the Eastern way of seeing. A child is born. Birth is a beginning of a circle. Death is the end of the circle. And the old man in his last moments again becomes as helpless as a child. And if things have gone rightly, he will become as innocent as the child. Then the circle is complete. Then his life was a round shaped life. Then his life will have a grace. If the circle is not complete, then the life will have something missing in it. Then there will be holes in his life. And his life will be tense. It will not be round. Graceful. Buddha says that in each life the wheel moves once. The circle becomes complete. Another life the wheel moves again. The spokes are the same. Again childhood, again youth, again old age. The same desires, the same passions, the same lust, the same rushing, the same ambition, the same struggle, conflict, the same aggression, the same ego, and again the same frustration, the same misery. This goes on and on and on. If you can penetrate into your deepest memories, then you will be able to see that you are not doing anything new here. That's why in the East they say there is nothing new under the sun. Everything has been done millions of times. So it became a very methodological thing in Buddhism and Jainism for every seeker to penetrate into his past memories. It became a necessary thing. Because Buddha says, unless you see the whole nonsense of repetition, you will continue to repeat. Just think about it. If you come across the whole record and you see for millions of times you have been fallen in love and every time you were miserable, now it is time enough to understand. Now don't be foolish again. If you say for millions of times you were born and you died again and every birth brings death, then now what is the point in clinging to life? Then renounce it. If you see that every time you expected, you were frustrated. Never your expectations were fulfilled. Then what is the point now? Now drop expecting. This became a basic meditation. To go into one's past memories. If you look even in one life, you will see constant repetition. Even at the very old age, you go on being the same way. It simply shows that you have not learned anything in life. Everybody passes through experience, but that is not necessarily a learning. There is a difference between passing through life and learning. Learning means you go on looking at your experiences. You keep a record of the experiences. You observe your experiences and you gather certain wisdom through them. You were angry and you did something foolish. Again you are angry and you do something foolish. Again you are angry, but you never take account of all your angers. And you never look at the mechanicalness of it. And you don't learn a lesson out of it. Then you experienced, but you have not learned anything. If you simply experience, you become old. If you learn, you become wise. All old people are not wise. Wisdom has nothing to do with old age. A real man of understanding can become wise any time. Even as a child, he can become wise. If you have a penetrating understanding, even single experience of anger, and you will be finished with it. It is so ugly. A single experience of greed, and you will be finished with it. It is so poisonous. I have heard, I am leaving home. Shouted Mahmud to his father Mullah Nasruddin, I want wine, women, adventures. His old man got up out of his chair. Don't try to stop me. Mahmud yelled at him, who is trying to stop you? Exclaimed old Mullah, I am coming with you. The same foolishness continues. Young and old, educated, uneducated, poor, rich, all seem to be in the same boat. They don't seem to learn. If you learn, a totally different vision arises in your life. I have heard it was in the early barn-storming days of aviation, and the old fellow had finally worked up enough nerve to take a flight on a plane. When the rickety plane landed, the old fellow crawled out and said, Sir, I want to thank you for both of those rides. What are you talking about? Asked the pilot. You had only one ride. No, replied the passenger. I had two rides, my first and my last. If you understand a thing, then it is your first and last. Then you have had it enough of it. Then it is not one ride, it is two rides. This sutra today consists of a question from a monk. A monk asked the Buddha, under what conditions is it possible to come to the knowledge of the past and to understand the most supreme way? Under what conditions is it possible to come to the knowledge of the past? Buddha insisted very much. He said, first move towards the past. First go backwards. Because that is where you have lived for millennia. Just look what you have been doing here. What has been your experience up to now? Go into it. Gather some lessons out of it. Otherwise you will tend to commit the same mistakes again and again. And there is a natural mechanism which does not allow you to remember it ordinarily. When a person dies and is reborn again, there comes a gap between his past life and the new life, a layer of oblivion, forgetfulness. It is natural, because it will be very difficult for you to live if you continuously remember all that has happened before. Not only at the end of life, every day it is happening. Millions of things happen in the day. You don't remember all. Not that they are not recorded, they are all recorded. It is unbelievable that how the mind goes on recording minute, small things. Whatsoever happens around you, you may not be even aware of it that it is happening, but the mind goes on recording. For example, you are listening to me, you are focused towards me, you are deeply in concentration, but the train is passing by. You may not have heard it at all. As far as your consciousness is concerned, if somebody asks you later on, was there a train going by? Did you hear the noise? You may say, I don't remember because I was so concentrated. But your mind has recorded it. Even without your knowing it, mind goes on recording. If you are hypnotized and then asked, the mind will say everything. If I asked you suddenly, what happened on the 1st January 1970, what happened? Can you remember? You will be simply blank. That does not mean that nothing happened on that day. Something must have happened. A quarrel with your wife, or a headache. 24 hours, 1st January 1970, something must have happened. 24 hours cannot be vacant, otherwise you would have become a Buddha. If you had remained 24 hours empty, nothing happening, then nirvana would have happened. But you don't remember at all. You will shrug your shoulders that I don't remember. Unless something very special had happened on that day, that there was a car accident and you were almost killed, maybe you will remember it. Or some type of other accident, you got married, you will remember it, because there is no way to forget it now. You cannot forget and you cannot forgive yourself for it. It remains like a wound. But otherwise you are completely forgetful. But if you are hypnotized and you go in a deep trance and the hypnotist asks you, now go backwards, remember 1st January 1970 and start from the morning relating what happened, you will relate such minute things that the tea was cold and I didn't like it at all, that the night was not good and I had a nightmare. Things like this you will remember. Minute details, that a dog was barking when I was taking my morning tea. That the cup from my hand had fallen and broke. Small things that I was passing by the side of a tree, and the tree had bloomed, and you will remember the smell. Or it had rained, and there was beautiful smell coming out of the earth. You may not only remember, you will relive it. It will be so clear. Everything is recorded. But you have to forget it. Otherwise your mind will be so much cluttered with unnecessary information that you will not be able to manage your life. So there is a natural mechanism which goes on sorting out. Inside you, much work continues 24 hours. A great sorting out goes on. Whatsoever is unessential is thrown into the basement. You may never need it. Secondary things which are not so absolutely irrelevant, you may need sometime, but there is no urgency about them. They are put into the subconscious within reach. If sometimes you need them, you can bring them back to consciousness. And very few things are left in the conscious which you will need every day. For example, 2 plus 2 is 4. This remains in the conscious. You will need it every day, every moment. That this is your wife and this is your husband remains in the conscious. If you go on forgetting every day, it will create difficulties in life. That your name and your address and your phone number. So, anything, almost 99.9% falls into the basement and disappears forever. But it remains there, underground. It can be recalled by specific methods. That's what in primal therapy they are doing. They are trying to recall all that has disappeared into the tunnels of the unconscious, to relive it. Once it is relived, you are freed from it. What primal therapists are doing now, Buddha has done 25 centuries before, and on a greater, in a greater way, in a deeper way. Not only with this life, he has done it with the whole past. You have to pass through the womb again in your memory. Then you have to go back to the death that happened in the last life. Then go on moving to the birth in the last life. And this way one goes on moving back and back and back. And the more you practice it, the more you become efficient in revealing all the mysteries that you have been carrying. You are carrying a great record. And if you can relive it, you will be able to find out few lessons out of it. Those lessons will be of tremendous value. They will be liberating. They will liberate you from your past. Once you are liberated from the past, you are liberated from the future also. Because then there is nothing left to project. Once you are liberated from your past lives, you are liberated from life itself. Then all desires to cling to life disappear. Then you don't want to be born again. then you don't want to cling, then you are not afraid of death. Then you don't want to be confined in any womb, in any body, you don't want to be embodied again. You would like absolute freedom. This learning can be done in two ways. Either while you are living, learn it. If you do that, you will become a Buddha. Slowly. If you have not done that, then go backwards and relive your past experiences, your past lives. The monk asked Buddha, under what conditions is it possible to come to the knowledge of the past and to understand the most supreme way? Because first you have to understand your past lives, then only you can ask in a meaningful way how to get out of it. Where is the exit? The way. When Buddha talks about the way, he means the way out. You have entered into life, now where is the way out? I have heard, Mike was going to Dublin for the last time and his friend Pat was giving him a few hints on what to do and where to go in the big city. What do I do when I go to the zoo? Asked Mike. You be careful about the zoo, advised Pat. You will see fine animals if you follow the words to the lions or to the elephants, but take no notice of to the exit. It is a fraud. It is outside I found myself when I went to look at it. That we have been doing. We have been avoiding the door that takes it out of life. We have avoided it for so long that almost it has become invisible to us. We have ignored it so long that it almost does not exist for us. Even if we come across it, we will not be able to recognize it. To the exit. Those words have become very faint. They have almost disappeared. We know only the entrance into life. We don't know the exit. Entrance, of course, we know because we have entered many times. Again and again we entered in the womb. Here you die and there you enter. Almost within minutes, at the most within days. Here you die, even while dying, your mind starts planning where to enter. You have not yet died and you are already planning for the future, where to enter, how to enter. The fantasy has started working again. Remember, it is your decision to enter in the womb, that's why you enter. You are not thrown in it. You choose it. As the entrance exists, so exists the exit. The monk is asking, under what conditions it is possible to come to the knowledge of the past and to understand the most supreme way? The Buddha said, those who are pure in heart and simple in purpose are able to understand the most supreme way. Those who are pure in heart and single in purpose. People who live in their heads will find it very difficult to move into the past. Because the head is always in the future. Head is really a mechanism to plan for the future. It always moves ahead of you. It is like a radar. In a plane you must have seen a radar. The radar moves ahead of the plane. That is its sole meaning. 200 miles ahead, 400 miles ahead. On the radar, the clouds that are 400 miles ahead start appearing. Because within seconds, the plane will be reaching. So the pilot has to know beforehand. Because if he comes to know only when he has reached, then it will be too late. The speed is so much. Mind is a radar. Your head is a radar system. It goes on groping in the future. It goes on planning for the future. It is never here in the present. And with the past it has nothing to do. It has already disappeared. The whole interest of the head is in the future. Even if sometimes it looks at the past, it looks only to find few clues for the future. Even if it wants to look into the past, it is just as a help to prepare for the future. But the interest, the center of interest is the future. Buddha says, pure in the heart and single in purpose. People who are not in the head but in their heart, only they can enter into the past lives. Heart is very close to the unconscious basement. Head is farthest away. Heart is closer to your navel center. Just somewhere near the navel is the corresponding point in the body with your unconscious. You have to come to the heart. Heart is midway between the head and the navel. If you become more and more full of feeling, full of heart, you will become capable to know, to enter into that great story of your past lives. It is the not only your biography, it is the biography of the whole universe. Because sometimes you were a tree and still your mind deep down in the unconscious carrying all those memories of being a tree. Someday you were a tiger and someday you were a cat. And someday you were an elephant, and someday you were a woman, and someday you were a man, and millions of memories are there. The whole drama of life is there, in a very condensed form. If you go into it, it starts a play. You can listen again those sounds. That's why in hypnosis it is possible, if you hypnotize a person and tell him that now you have become a tiger, he becomes a tiger. You may have seen hypnotists doing on the stage. They tell to a man that you have become a woman. Now walk. And the man walks like a woman. It is very difficult, but he manages. He may have never walked like a woman. Now how suddenly he starts walking like a woman? It is very difficult because the woman has a totally different structure of the body. Because of the womb existing in her body, she has a different type of skeleton. She moves in a different way. Her movement is more round and more shapely. She cannot run fast. A man moves differently. But under hypnotic influence, the man can walk like a woman. The woman can walk like a man. Not only that, a person who has never heard a single word of Arabic or Latin or Chinese can be provoked under hypnosis to speak Chinese. And if the hypnosis is really deep, he may start speaking Chinese. It is a miracle, and the hypnotist has not been yet able to explain it. How to explain it? What happens? The explanation is simple if you understand Buddha's hypothesis. Buddha says, And that is agreed by all the Eastern masters, that a man has been everything in his past lives. You have been a Chinese, you have been a Japanese, you have been a German, you have been a Tibetan. So if somewhere deep in your memories the life that you lived as a Chinese is still there, it can be provoked under hypnosis. It can be revealed. You can start speaking Chinese. You have never heard a single word about it. You don't know anything about it. A human being is vast. It is not so much confined as you think. You think you are a Hindu, are a Mohammedan, are a Christian, are a Indian, are a Japanese, are a Chinese. These are just boundaries on your conscious mind. On the unconscious, you are infinite territory. You are all. Not only Hindu and Mohammedan and Christian, but even a tiger, a cat, a mouse, a lion, a tree, a rock, a cloud. You are vast. You are as vast as this universe. Once you start entering, you will become tremendously aware that no limitation exists. All limitations are a sort of belief. You believe, that's why they are there. If you drop them, they start disappearing. Those who are pure in heart and simple in purpose, people who are more heart-oriented, are single of purpose. They are not crooked. They are not cunning. The head is very cunning. The head is like a fox, very calculating and very subtle in its ways. If it wants something, it will never go direct. If it wants something, it will go zigzag. It will say something else, it will do something else, it would like to get something else. The head is very political, diplomatic. You can watch it in yourself, how the head goes on deceiving, how the head goes on being political. It is never authentic. It cannot be. The heart is authentic. It knows no deception. It goes direct. The heart moves in straight lines. The head goes very zigzag. Buddha says a person who wants to enter into his past lives will need singleness of purpose. Crookedness won't do. One will have to follow straight, simple, direct, and able to understand the most supreme way. These people who are simple, heart-oriented, single, straight, direct, immediate, these people enter easily. It has become more and more difficult since the days of Buddha to enter into past lives. It was so simple in Buddha's time. People were simple. Almost every sannyasin that was initiated by Buddha had to pass through past experiences, and the same was true with Mahavira. There is a famous story. A prince took sannyas, was initiated by Mahavira. But he had lived always in comfort, in richness, and now the life was very hard with Mahavir. He had to move naked, to sleep on hard floors, with no clothes. It was difficult. The first night, and he started thinking to drop out. This is not for him. There were so many mosquitoes that, as they have always been in India, they seem to be constant enemies of meditators. He could not meditate, so many mosquitoes, and he was naked, and it was cold. And the place where he was sleeping was just in the middle, and hundreds of sannyasins were staying, and whole night he could not sleep. People were coming and going. It was very crowded, and he had never lived in that way. That was not his way of life. So in the night, he started feeling that next morning he will leave. It is said in the middle of the night, Mahavir came to him. He was surprised. He said, "Why you have come?" Mahavir told him that, "I have been watching you. I know your difficulty. But this has happened before. This is in fact third time. You have been initiated twice before in your other lives, and every time you have left." He said, "What do you mean?" And Mahavir told him to do a certain technique of meditation that he calls Jati Ismaran, the method to remember the past life. And he told him, "You just do this the whole night, sit in meditation, and by the morning, whatsoever you decide." He went into his past life. It seems very simple, it must have been. People must have been simple. He went into his past life so easily, and by the morning he came, he was full of new light. He touched Mahavir's feet and he said, "I have decided to stay. Enough is enough. I looked into, yes, you were right. How long I can go on repeating it again and again? It is insulting to take sannyas and leave it. It is below dignity. No, it is not good for a warrior like me to be afraid of mosquitoes, to be afraid of small inconveniences. But you were right, twice also it has happened the same way. I was initiated and the first night I became disturbed and the next morning I left. And I was going to do it again. So grateful to you that you reminded me. Otherwise I would have committed the same thing again, thinking that this I am doing for the first time." All the sannyasins of Buddha and Mahavira had to pass through Jati Ismaran, through the memory of all the past lives. Today it has become very difficult. Difficult because the head has become very heavy. Head is so heavy and energy is so much monopolized by the head that it is not flowing in the heart at all. And the path towards past lives goes through the heart. So if you want to remember past lives, and it is a great experience, very revealing and very liberating, you will have to live for a few months and years a very simple-hearted life, the life of feelings. Don't allow your thinking to dominate you. Let feeling balance it. Don't allow logic to be dictatorial. Let love decide. And by, you will see the ways of the heart are very simple. And they are always single in purpose. When a heart falls in love with somebody, then there is no problem. Then your love object is the only love object for you. The moment a heart has fallen in love with a woman, then that is the only woman in the world. Then all the women have disappeared for you. Heart is single in purpose. But if a head has fallen in love, in fact it has not fallen in love, it simply pretends, then it is difficult. Then any woman that passes on the stage attracts you, provokes you. Then any passing influence distracts you. Love knows single purposeness, because love is really of the heart. If you are here with me through the heart, then it is a totally different relationship. Then it is going to be eternal. Then I can die, you can die, but the relationship cannot die. But if it is only of the head, if you are simply convinced what I am saying, not convinced what I am, if you are only convinced by what I am saying, my logic, my argument, then this relationship is very temporary. Tomorrow you will be convinced by somebody else. Tomorrow somebody else can give you a better argument. Then it disappears. Just two nights before, a young man from the West came, husband of a sannyasin. I asked him, "Have you something to say to me? Why you have come to me?" He said, "My wife told me to come to you." I said, "Then it is not worth, because your wife told you to come to me. So you have come. Your coming is very accidental. You have not come to me. You are simply obliging your wife. Then don't waste my time. You can oblige your wife in many other ways. This is no way." Then he listened to me, I talked to his wife, and then in the end he said, "I'm thinking to take sannyas." I asked him, "Thinking? Then it will be difficult. Even if you are convinced by thinking, you may become a sannyasin. Outwardly, inwardly you will never be a sannyasin, because it will be a head thing. Sannyas is not a logical conviction. It is a conversion in love. But he couldn't understand. He said, "I will think about it." If he comes, then too he will not be coming. Because he will come only because he is convinced, his head is convinced. He will not be convinced by me. He will be convinced only by his head, or maybe by his wife. The wife may persuade him. She persuaded him to come from Europe to here. So she can persuade him to change the clothes also. He may find some rationalizations, but the whole thing is pointless. Unless you come through the heart, you don't come. Unless you reach me through the heart, you don't reach at all. Remember it. Religion is something that happens into your source of feelings. It has nothing to do with your thinking. Pure in heart and single in purpose are capable to understand the most supreme way. And once you have seen your past lives, suddenly you see the way out. Because so many times you have come in, again and again. The way to come in is really the way to come out also. Just see, you have to move in the opposite direction. The way is the same. The entrance and the exit are not two. The direction is different. When you enter into the house, you enter from the same door. You get out of the house, you get out of the same door. Just your direction is different. So Buddha says, if you look into your past lives and you see again and again clinging with life, clinging with lust, ambition, ego, greed, jealousy, possessiveness, these are the ways you have been coming in again and again. These are the ways to go out. If greed is the way to come in, no greed is the way to go out. If ego is the way to come in, no ego is the way to go out. If lust, desire, passion is the way to come in, then no passion, no desire. Our desirelessness is the way to go out. It is like polishing a mirror, which becomes bright when the dust is removed. Remove your passions and have no hankering, and the past will be revealed unto you. So Buddha says three things. First, pure in heart, single of purpose, and third, he says, your consciousness is so much cluttered that your mirror is not reflecting. Otherwise, you have such a beautiful mirror with such a penetrating capacity that wherever you move your mirror of consciousness, you will see everything that exists in that dimension. If you move your mirror towards the past, the whole past in toto will be revealed to you. If you remove your mirror towards the future, the whole future will be revealed to you. If you move your mirror to the present, the whole present will be revealed to you. Your consciousness is your key. It is like polishing a mirror, which becomes bright when the dust is removed. Too much dust of thinking, too much dust of impressions is covering your mirror. You have completely forgotten the mirror looks like a brick. Clean it, wash it. That's what we are doing in meditations. It is just an effort to clean the mirror, so it mirrors whatsoever is. Remove your passions and have no hankering, and the past will be revealed unto you. A monk asked the Buddha, what is good and what is great? The Buddha answered, good is to practice the way and to follow the truth. Great is the heart that is in accord with the way. Tremendously beautiful is his definition of the great. Understand as deeply as possible. Good is to practice the way. First one has to know the way. No greed, no ego, no violence, no desire. In a way, all are negatives. Because whatsoever you know as positive has been the door to come in. Eliminate the positive and you will find the door to go out. Good is to practice the way. Buddha says, knowing the way, recognizing the way in a clear mirror-like consciousness, the first thing that one has to do is to practice it. Just by recognizing it won't help. Just by recognizing it is not going to transform you. You have to walk, you have to discipline. Good is to practice the way and to follow the truth. You have had a vision of truth. It is very far away, like a distant star. Clear vision.
But the distance is great. You have to follow. You have to move towards it, slowly, gradually. You have to prepare for the journey. This Buddha calls good. This is what virtue is. And great is the heart that is in accord with the way. When you are practicing, there is bound to be a little struggle. When you are disciplining yourself, there is bound to be a little conflict, because the old habits will come in the way. You have always been greedy. Now suddenly you decide not to be greedy. The whole past will come in the way, will distract you. Old habits will again and again possess you. Again and again you will forget and waver. There is bound to be struggle. So Buddha says it is good, but not great. Great is the man whose struggle is gone, whose discipline also is gone, who is simply, spontaneously in accord with the way, is the great man. That's what Buddha calls great, in accord. He is so surrendered that it is now natural for him. Not to desire has become as natural to him as it is natural ordinarily to desire. Not to be ambitious has become as natural as it is natural for people to be ambitious. People are habitually in discord with the way, and he becomes naturally in accord. Pythagoras calls this state harmonia. That is the right word, in accord. Harmonia, in harmony. Lao Tzu calls this Tao. Buddha calls it Dhamma. To be in accord, as if you are not swimming, not struggling. You are completely relaxed and floating with the river. You are so one with the river that there is not even a slight distance between you and the river. You don't have any of your desires. You don't have any private goals. You go with the river to the ocean. A man of harmonia, accord, Tao, Dhamma, is the most beautiful flowering in this world. He is the lotus flower of consciousness. Great is the heart that is in accord with the way. But it cannot happen immediately. First you will have to discipline. And then you will have to drop discipline also. First you will have to make it a point to relax. And then you will have to forget relaxation also. First you will have to fight with your old ingrained habits. And once you have got over them, you have to drop new habits that you must have created in fighting with the old. First you have to meditate, then one day you have to drop meditation also. Meditation is good. Dropping of the meditation is great. Being a saint is good. Being holy is great. Being a good person is good. But not great, because a good person still carries a subtle fight with the bad. He is constantly conflicting with the devil, with the evil inside himself. He is not at ease. He cannot relax. He knows that if he relaxes, the old, the past is big and powerful, and he will be possessed and he will be thrown off balance. He has to continuously balance himself. A good man, a saint, is still not in absolute akar. He is trying hard. He is trying his best. And he should be appreciated that he is trying. That's why Buddha calls him good. So never be satisfied by good. Remember, to be great is the goal. To be so deeply in akash that you simply disappear and only the Dhamma remains, only the Tao remains, only nature remains. You are just a wave in the ocean and you don't exist separately. Your separate existence, yourself, has to be dropped. The bad man has a self. The self is created by fighting against the law, against nature. The bad man has a self. He creates the self by fighting against Dhamma. Whatsoever is good, he fights against it and creates a self. The good man also has a self. He fights against his bad habits that he has created in the past. Because of fight, he has also a self. The bad man has an ego. The good man has an ego. The bad man's ego is based on his mischief. The good man's ego is based on his virtue. But both have egos. The great is one whose ego has disappeared, who is completely immersed, merged into the whole. To be so merged into the whole, to be in such a harmony, is to be great. That is what is required. That is what has to be remembered continuously. Never lose sight of it. Life is just a training. One has to become so transcendental that not even good satisfies. One has to be continuously in a divine discontent to attain to this excellent transcendence where you are lost and only the whole is. When you have completely surrendered, when you have given the way to the whole, you have become just a space. If you want to use non-Buddhist terms, you can say it surrender to God. You are so empty that God can descend in you. If you want to use Buddhist terms, then he says, you are not there, now only the law functions. Now only the Dhamma, the Tao, goes on functioning. To function in such accord is bliss, Sachidananda.
The Buddha said, my doctrine is to think the thought that is unthinkable, to practice the deed that is non-doing, to speak the speech that is inexpressible, and to be trained in the discipline that is beyond discipline. Those who understand this are near. Those who are confused are far. The way is beyond words and expressions, is bound by nothing earthly. Lose sight of it to an inch, or miss it for a moment, and we are away from it forevermore. This sutra is one of the most important, one of the very central to Buddha's message, the very essence of his message. Is there like a seed. Go patiently with me into it. Try to understand it. Because if you understand this sutra, you would have understood all that Buddha wants you to understand. If you miss this sutra, you miss all. The Buddha said, my doctrine is to think the thought that is unthinkable, to practice the deed that is non-doing, to speak the speech that is inexpressible, and to be trained in the discipline that is beyond discipline. The choice of the word doctrine is unfortunate. But there are difficulties in translating. Buddha must have used the word Siddhanta. It has a totally different meaning. Ordinarily it is translated as doctrine. It should not be translated so. But the problem is that in the English language there is no equivalent to Siddhanta. So I would have to explain it to you. A doctrine is a consistent logical theory. A Siddhanta has nothing to do with logic, theory, consistency. A Siddhanta is a realization. A Siddhanta is an experience. A doctrine is intellectual. A Siddhanta is existential. You can make a doctrine without being transformed by it. You can make a great doctrine without even touched by it. But if you want to achieve a Siddhanta, you will have to be totally transformed. Because it will be a vision of a totally different person. The word Siddhanta means the assertion of one who has become a Siddha, one who has achieved, one who has arrived. His statement. You can be a great philosopher. You can figure out intellectually many things. You can systematize your inferences. And you can make a very consistent logical syllogism, which almost appears like truth, but is not truth. It has been manufactured by your mind. A doctrine is man-made. A Siddhanta has nothing to do with man and his efforts. A Siddhanta is a vision. You come upon it. For example, a blind man can think about light and can try to figure it out what it is all about. He can even listen to great treatises on light and he can make a certain idea about it, what it is. But he will be as far away from light as he was before. He can even expound the doctrine about light. He can explain its physics. He can explain its structure. He can go deeper into the constituents of light. He can talk about it. He can write a PhD on it, a thesis. He can be declared a doctor by a university because he has propounded a doctrine. But still, he does not know what light is. He has no eyes to see. A Siddhanta is one which you have seen, which has been revealed to you, which has become your own experience, which you have encountered. A doctrine is almost imaginary. It is not real. A doctrine is almost always borrowed. You can hide your borrowing in many ways, subtle, cunning ways. You can reformulate. You can take from many sources and you can rearrange everything. But a doctrine is a borrowed thing. Nothing original in it. A Siddhanta is absolutely original, new. It is your authentic experience. You have come to see what reality is. It is an immediate perception. It is a benediction. It is a blessing. It is a grace, a gift. You have arrived and you have seen what truth is. The statement of a realization is Siddhanta. Propounding a doctrine is one thing. Giving expression to a Siddhanta is totally different. I have heard once Mullah Nasruddin was talking to few of his friends. He was telling his pals about the wonderful vacation he and his family had just had in the United States. "It is a wonderful country," he exclaimed. "Nowhere in the world is a stranger treated so well. You walk along the street and you meet a well-dressed fellow with lots of dollars. He tips his hat and he smiles at you and you talk together. He invites you into his big car and shows you the town. He buys you a fine dinner, then takes you to the theater. You have more fine food and plenty of drinks. Then he invites you to his house and you sleep nice all night. Next morning, what?" Nasruddin, a listener, said, "Did all this really happen to you?" "No, not exactly, but it all happened to my wife," said Nasruddin. A doctrine is that which has happened to somebody else. You have heard about it. It has not happened to you. It is borrowed, dirty, ugly. A Siddhanta is virgin. A doctrine is a prostitute. It has been moving through many minds, through many hands. It is like dirty currency. It goes on changing its owner. A Siddhanta is something absolutely fresh. It has never happened before. It will never happen again. It has happened to you. A Siddhanta is deeply individual. It is a personal vision of reality. What happened to Buddha is Siddhanta. What Buddhists propound is a doctrine. What happened to Christ is a Siddhanta. What Christians talk about is a doctrine. What happened to Krishna is a Siddhanta. What Hindus go on bragging about is a doctrine. What I am saying to you is a siddhanta. If you go and repeat it, it will be a doctrine. That's why I say it is a very unfortunate choice of word to put into Buddha's mouth. My doctrine is to think. No. Let it be my siddhanta is to think. My realization is to think. My own understanding is to think. He is not proposing a theory. He is simply expressing an experience. Few more things before we enter into the sutra. A siddhanta is by its very nature paradoxical. Has to be so, because life is paradoxical. If you really have experienced it, then whatsoever you see and say is going to be paradoxical. Life consists of contradictions. We call them contradictions. Life does not call them contradictions. They are complementaries. Day and night dance together. Life and death dance together. Love and hate move hand in hand. We call them contradictions. In life they are not so. Life is big and vast, immense. It comprehends all the contradictions into it. They are complementaries. When a person has realized whatsoever he says is going to have the taste of paradox, that's why all great religious assertions are paradoxical. They may be in the Vedas, in the Upanishads, in Quran, in Bible, in Tao Te Ching, wherever. Whenever you will find truth, you will find paradoxical. Because the truth has to be total. Totality is paradoxical. A doctrine is never paradoxical. A doctrine is tremendously consistent. Because a doctrine is not worried about reality. A doctrine is worried about being consistent. It knows no reality. It is a mind game. And the mind is very, very logical. And the mind says, don't allow any contradiction in it. The mind says, if you talk about light, then don't talk about darkness. Because that will be inconsistent. Forget about darkness. The mind tries to prove that life is non-contradictory. Because that is the mind's choice. Mind is very afraid of contradictions. Becomes very sick when it comes across a contradiction. It insists its own pattern. Mind is logical, life is not. So if you find something very logical, beware. Something must be wrong in it. It must not be part of life. It must be man-made. Everything God made is contradictory. That's why people go on arguing about God. Why? If He loves men so much, then why He created death? The mind feels it very difficult to accept the idea that God created life and also death. If it was up to you, if you were the maker of the world, if mind was the creator, then you would have never done that. But think of a life where no death exists. It will be sheer boredom. It will be tedium. Think, if death is impossible, then you will be continuously in hell. If mind has created the world, then there will be only love, no hate. But think of a world where only love exists. Then it will be too sweet. Sweet to the point of being nauseous. It will lose all taste. It will lose all color. It will be flat. Love is beautiful because of the possibility of hate. If mind was to create the world, or Aristotle was asked to create the world, then there would have been only day, no night. Only work, no play. Then think, what would have happened? God, in his compassion, never took any advice from Aristotle. And maybe that's the reason he created man in the very end. First he created other things, otherwise man will start giving advice. That has been a problem, why he created man in the end. First he created trees and the earth and the sky and the stars and the animals and the birds and the whole. Then he waited and waited. Then he created man. And first he created man, then he created woman. Because man may, just out of politeness, may have kept quiet, but a woman cannot keep quiet. He must have been afraid. Don't create man, otherwise he will start giving advice. Do this, don't do that. And for woman he waited last. And since he created woman, he has disappeared. Otherwise the woman would have nagged him to death. One great industrialist was saying to me that for his new factory, everything has been planned, agreed upon, the engineers, the architects, and the planners, they have done everything and everything has been agreed. But I asked them, why you repeat again and again everything agrees? Has something gone wrong? He said, then I came home and talked about it to my wife. Finished. Now she is suggesting things which will alter the whole idea. And if I don't do it now, then it will be a constant problem for my whole life. She will nag me to death. If Aristotle was asked to create the world or help the world to be created, then the world would have been absolutely consistent, absolutely consistent. But then it would have been a world of misery and hell. Life is beautiful because there are contradictions. Work is beautiful because there is play. Work means you are doing something to get something out of it. Play means you are simply doing it for its own sake. No, Aristotle won't allow it. Plato won't allow it. In his Republic, Plato says, there will be no possibility for any poets. We won't allow them. They are dangerous people. They bring contradiction in the world. Poets. They are dreamers. And they talk in such ways which are vague, ambiguous. You cannot make anything out of it, what they are saying, what they mean. In Plato's world, in his Republic, logicians, philosophers will be the kings. They will decide. It has not yet happened. Only few things like that has happened. For example, Soviet Russia is more Platonic. China is more Platonic. These two countries are run by logic. You cannot find more miserable people anywhere else. Everything has been arranged. Only life is missing. Somehow, man is not happy because man cannot live by bread alone. You need the opposite also. The whole day you work, in the night you rest. You need darkness also. A doctrine is a logical statement of a theory. And logic is like a chameleon. It goes on changing its color. It is not reliable. It is not reliable because it is not based in reality. It is not responsible because it is not based in reality. It is untrue because it is partial truth. Remember, a partial truth is more untrue than a total untruth. Because a partial truth gives a feeling of being true. It is only half true, and nothing can be half true. Either it is true or it is not true. A half-truth is absolutely untrue, but logic gives it a feeling that it is true. At least on the way towards truth. It is not even on the way towards truth. And logicians go on doing somersaults. They go on changing their standpoints. Because in fact they have not come to anything that is really real, just their mind games. One day one game, another day another game, they go on changing. They remain consistent. Consistent with their own train of thought, but inconsistent with reality. I have heard, it is difficult to explain what a course of logic will do for a person's thinking, but let me illustrate. Said Mullah Nasruddin to his son, suppose two men came out of a chimney, one is clean, one dirty, which one will take a bath? The dirty one naturally answered, the boy. Remember, chided Nasruddin, that the clean man sees the dirty one and sees how dirty he is and vice versa. Now I get it, Dad. Answered the boy, the clean one seeing his dirty companion concludes he is dirty too, so he takes the bath. Am I right now? Wrong, said Nasruddin nonchalantly. Logic teaches us this. How could two men come out of a chimney, one clean and one dirty? Once you start playing the game of logic, there is no end to it, and you will never win. The logician will always win. The logician will always win because you can always find a way. And you have nothing to compare with. You have no reality. That's why so many philosophies exist. And all opposing each other. And not a single conclusion has been arrived yet. Down the centuries, almost for 5,000 years, man has argued. Man has not been doing much, but just arguing. Thousands of philosophies have been created. Very neat and clean logic. If you read one philosopher, you will be convinced. If you read his opponent, you will be convinced. Read the third one, you will be convinced, and you will be getting into a mess. By and by, you will be convinced by all, and you will be mad. Because you will not know now what is true. They are all wrong, because the logical approach is wrong. There are two ways to know reality. One is just close your eyes and think about it. I call it aboutism. It is always about and about. It never goes directly. You go on beating around the bush. You never beat exactly the bush, just around. You never penetrate the center of a problem. You simply go round and round. It is a merry-go-round. You can enjoy it. Logicians enjoy very much. It is so beautiful to come with a new theory which explains everything. But it is just in the mind. You close your eyes, sit on your easy chair and think about. This is not going to give you reality. Reality is already there. You are not to think about it. You have to allow it. You have to drop all thinking so that you can see what is the truth, so that you can see that which is. If you go on thinking, you cannot see that which is. It is impossible. Your thoughts will create a smoke around you. Your consciousness will be covered by the smoke. Your eyes will not have clarity. You will not have sensitivity. And continuously you will be searching and seeking your own ideas, imposing them, projecting them on reality. And you will not give reality a chance to reveal itself. A doctrine is arrived through logical thinking. A doctrine comes through the process of aboutism. A siddhanta is arrived not by closing your eyes, not by thinking too much, but by dropping thinking as such in toto, by opening your eyes with no prejudice, with no a priori conceptions, and looking direct into reality, facing reality direct. It is already there, it needs only you to be there. And when you are absolutely without any thoughts, your mind is still. Your memory is still. Your thinking has completely ceased to be. Then reality erupts, explodes. Then you become a receiver. Then Siddhanta arises. My Siddhanta is to think the thought that is unthinkable. The first thing Buddha says is to think the thought that is unthinkable. It is a contradiction, a paradox. Now no logician will ever utter such nonsense. It is from the very beginning nonsensical. That's why logicians go on saying that Buddha, Jesus, Bodhidharma, Lao Tzu, Zarathustra, these people are all nonsense. Their propositions are meaningless. Because they say one thing and in the next breath they contradict it. Now look at this sentence. My Siddhanta is to think the thought that is unthinkable. Now just in a small sentence, absolute contradiction. To think the unthinkable. How can you think the unthinkable? If it is really unthinkable, you cannot think. If you can think, then how it can be unthinkable? Simple. Illogical. But what Buddha means has to be understood. Don't be in a hurry, that's why I say go patiently. When he wants to say something, he means it. He's saying there is a way to know things without thinking. There is a way to know things without mind. There is a way to see into reality directly, immediately, without the vehicle of thought. You can be connected without any agent of thinking with reality. That's what he is saying. He is saying that the mind can completely cease its activity, completely can drop its activity, and yet be still a reservoir and see into reality. But you will have to experience it, only then you will be able to understand. Sometimes try just to see. Sitting by the side of a rose bush, just look at the rose flower. Don't think. Don't even give names. Don't even classify. Don't even say that this is a rose, because a rose is a rose, is a rose. Whether you call it rose or something else makes no difference. So don't label it. Don't give it a name. Don't bring language in. Don't bring any symbol in, because symbol is the method of falsifying reality. If you said this is a rose, you have already missed. Then you have brought some past experience of other roses in, which are not. Now your eyes are full of roses, rose of roses. In your life you must have come across many types of roses, white and black and red. All those roses are there, floating in your eyes. Now you are crowded by your past memories. And then beyond those all memories is this rose which is real. Now the crowd of the unreal is so much, you will not be able to reach and touch the real. When Buddha says, drop thinking, he means, don't bring the past in. What is the point of bringing it in? This rose is here. You are here. Let it be a deep meeting, a communion, a connection. Melt a little with this rose. Let this rose melt a little in you. The rose is ready to share its fragrance. You also share your being, your consciousness with it. Let there be a handshake with reality. Let there be a little dance with this rose, dancing in the wind. You also move, be, look, feel, close your eyes, smell, touch, drink this beautiful phenomenon that is facing you. Don't go here and there, just be with it. No more life right and left. Just be direct, like an arrow moving towards the target. If you bring words, language, you bring society, you bring past, you bring other people. Tennyson has said something about the rose. Shelley has said something about the rose. Shakespeare has said something about the rose. R. Kalidasa. Once you bring language, Shakespeare and Kalidas and Bhavabhuti and Shelley and Keats, they are all standing there. Now you are too full of your own ideas. Now you are in a crowd, lost. You will not be able to see the simple truth. The truth is so simple, yes, it is just like a rose flower in front of you. It is utterly there. Why go somewhere else? Why not move into this reality? Why go in time, past and future? Don't say this rose is beautiful. Because this rose needs no compliments from you. Let it be a feeling. This rose does not understand human language. So why puzzle this rose? Why say you are beautiful? Because this rose knows nothing of beauty and nothing of ugliness. For this rose, life is not divided and split. This rose is not schizophrenic. This rose is simply there, with no idea of what beauty is and what ugliness is. Don't call it beautiful. When you call it beautiful, you have brought a concept. The mind had started functioning. Now, you may have a little experience of the rose, but it will not be true. Your mind will be a distortion. You will think this rose just as a representative of all other roses. Plato says that every real thing is just a representative of something ideal. Plato says there with God exists the idea of rose. That is real. The idea of rose is real. And this rose is just a reflection of that idea. This is nonsense. This is really absurd. This rose exists here now with God. There is no idea in the mind of God. God has no mind as such. God is without mind. God is not a human being. And God has not been trained by any parents. And God has not been educated by any university. God has not been conditioned. There is no idea in the mind of God. And this rose is a real rose. And God exists with this rose, and this rose exists with God. And God has no barrier with this rose. No mind barrier. But for Plato, the reality is unreal, and ideas are real. For Buddha, it is just the opposite. The reality is real, and ideas are unreal. If you follow Plato, you will become a philosopher. If you follow Buddha, you will become a religious man. Religion is not a philosophy. Religion is an experience. So try it. Sometimes allow your no mind to function. Sometimes push aside all your thinking. Sometimes let reality penetrate you. Sometimes let there be a blessing from reality. Allow it to deliver its message to you. But we go on living in words. And we pay too much attention to the words. I had a teacher in the university. And we used to go for a walk together. Few days then I said, I will not come. Better I should go alone. He said, why? Because he was so much obsessed with names. Every tree which he will see, he has to say to which species it belongs. Every flower, what it contains, its history. If he will see rose, he will not see rose. He will see the whole history of rose, how it came from Iran. In what century? Who brought it to India? It is not an Indian flower. Now he will never look at the flower. And I will pull him again and again back that this flower is enough. What is the point? Flowers don't have histories, only human beings have. This flower does not bother whether it is in Iran or in India. This flower has no idea of any past. It lives just here now. It is neither Hindu nor Mohammedan, nor Indian nor Iranian. It is simply there. It is not even a rose. But it was difficult for him. Any bird he will say, he says, wait. Let me listen. What species this bird is, from where it has come? Has it come from Siberia? Are from Middle Asia? Or is it a Himalayan bird? After a few days I said, you excuse me. You go alone. Because I am not interested from where this bird has come. This bird is here. It is enough. I am not interested into the scientific, historical explanation. Explanation to few people is almost a disease. Through their explanations, they try to explain away everything. They are obsessed with explanation. They think if they can name a thing, label a thing, they know it. They are very uneasy unless they can label a thing, know a thing by name, categorize it, pigeonhole it. Unless they do it, they are very uncomfortable. It seems as if a certain thing is just offending them. Why you are there without any classification? Once they have categorized it, pigeonholed it, put a label on it, then they are at ease. They have known it. Finished they are with the thing. I have heard, after the Second World War, a German soldier raped a French woman and told her, in 9 months you will have a son. You may call him Adolf Hitler. To which the French woman replied, "In 9 days you will have a rash. You may call it measles." But by calling names, it changes nothing. What you call is absolutely irrelevant. Whatsoever is, is. By our giving it a name, it never changes. But for you, it changes. Just by giving a name, reality becomes different to you. It happens, a lion and an ass made an agreement to go out hunting together. By and by they came to a cave where many wild goats abode. The lion took up his station at the mouth of the cave, and the ass, going within, kicked and brayed and made a mighty fuss to frighten them out. When the lion had caught very many of them, the ass came out and asked him if he had not made a noble fight and routed the goats properly. "Yes, indeed," said the lion, "and I assure you, you would have frightened me too if I had not known you to be an ass." It may make a difference to you by calling names, but it does not make any difference to reality. It may make a difference to you because you live surrounded by our language, concept, verbalization. You immediately go on translating everything into language. De-language yourself, that's what Buddha means. Unmind yourself, unwind yourself, that's what Buddha means. Otherwise you will never know what is true. My Siddhanta is to think the thought that is unthinkable. You cannot think about reality. There is no way to think about it. All thinking is borrowed. No thinking is ever original. All thinking is repetitive. All thinking is mechanical. You can go on chewing and re-chewing the same things again and again and again, but nothing new ever arises out of thinking. Thinking is old, rotten. It is a junkyard. You cannot think about reality because reality is every moment original. It is every moment so new that it has never been like that before. It is so absolutely fresh that you will have to know it. There is no other way to know it than knowing it. The only way to know love is to love. The only way to know swimming is to swim. And the only way to know reality is to be real. Mind makes you unreal. Mind makes you too much like thoughts. Mind is stuff. Words, concepts, theories, philosophies, doctrines, scriptures, isms. Mind does not give you the real thing. It gives you only reflections, and those reflections are also distorted. Buddha says, attend to a clarity. Just see. Just be.
And then you will be able to think that thought which is unthinkable. You will be able to have a meeting with reality, a date with God. The thought that is unthinkable, that is only worth thinking. All else is just wasting life energy. To practice the deed that is non-doing, that is not doing. This is what Lao Tzu calls Wu Wei. Action in inaction. Again, another paradox. But a Siddhanta has to be paradoxical. To practice the deed that is not doing. Ordinarily, we know only deeds which we can do. We are surrounded by our doing. We don't know that there are things which are beyond our doing and still are happening. You are born. You have not given birth to yourself. It has simply happened. And it could not happen in a better way. You are breathing. But you are not breathing as an act. It is happening. You can try to stop it, and then you will see you cannot stop it. Even for few seconds, you cannot stop it. You will have to relax. You will have to allow it. Breathing is life. It is happening. All that is essential is happening. And all that is non-essential, existential is to be done. Of course, your shop will not be run if you don't run it. Of course, you will not become a prime minister or a president if you don't struggle for it. Nobody has ever become a prime minister without struggling for it. Without violence, you cannot become a prime minister. You will have to compete. A cutthroat competition. You will have to be cruel. You will have to be aggressive. You will have to do it, only then it can happen. All that depends on your doing is accidental. And all that goes on without you is essential. Religion's whole concern is the essential, the world of the essential. You are there. Not that you have done yourself. You are simply there for no reason. You have not earned it. It is nothing of your doing. It is a benediction. It is a gift. You are there. Existence has willed you to be there. It is not your own will. Watch it. Understand it. When such a thing like life, so precious, can happen without your doing, then why bother? Then allow more and more the dimension of a happening. Drop more and more doing. Do only that which seems needful. Don't be bothered too much with the doing. That is the meaning of a sannyasin. The householder, the grastha, is one who is simply possessed by the dimension of doing. He thinks if he is not going to do, nothing is going to happen. He is a doer. A sannyasin is one who knows that whether he is going to do it or not, all that is essential is going to continue to happen. Non-essential may disappear, but that is irrelevant. But the essential will continue. Love is essential, money is non-essential. To be alive is essential. To live in a big house or not is non-essential. To be fulfilled, contented, is essential. Rushing, ambitious, always trying to reach somewhere, trying to perform,
trying to prove that you are somebody is non-essential. People live only in two dimensions, the dimension of the doer and the dimension of the non-doer. Buddha says, to practice the deed that is not doing. He said, practice that. And he says practice because there is no other way to say it. The word practice looks like doing. That's the paradox. He says, do that which cannot be done. Do that which only happens. Allow, he means allow that which happens. Allow God to be there. Allow life to be there. Allow love to be there. Allow the existence to penetrate you, to infiltrate you. Don't continue to be a doer. He does not mean that don't do anything at all. He says don't emphasize it. Maybe it is needful. You have to clean your room. Without your doing it, it is not going to happen. So do it. But don't get obsessed with it. It is just a minor part. And the major part of life, the central part of life, should be like a happening. As the lightning happens in the clouds, so God happens. As rivers go on rushing towards the ocean and dissolve, so love happens. So happens meditation. It has nothing to do with your doing. Your doing is not essential for it to happen. It can happen when you are sitting and not doing anything. In fact, it happens only then, when you are not doing anything and you are sitting. I insist you to do many things as methods, but the insistence is only this, that you have to be tired, otherwise you won't sit. It is as if you tell to a child, sit silently in the corner of the room, and he cannot sit. He is so restless. He is so full of energy. He wants to do this and that and run around. The best way is to tell him to go and have 7 rounds, run around the house 7 times, around the block, then come back. Then without your telling, he will sit silently. That's the whole point of my insistence, that do dynamic, do kundalini, do Nataraj, be spent, so that for few moments, you can allow happening. You will not reach to meditation by doing. You will reach by meditation only to non-doing. And in non-doing will happen the real thing. The real thing cannot be produced. It always happens. One has to be just sensitive and open and vulnerable. It is very delicate. You cannot grab it. It is very fragile, fragile like a flower. You cannot grab it. If you grab it, you will destroy it. You have to be very soft. It is not hardware, it is software. You have to be really soft. You have to be feminine. Buddha says, practice the deed that is not doing. That is the message of all the great ones, the really great ones. The greatest realization on this earth have been this, that we are unnecessarily creating too much fuss. That which is to happen is going to happen if we wait. In the right season, the harvest. In the right season, the fruition. In the right season, everything happens. If a man can learn only one thing, how to wait prayerfully, nothing else is needed. ecstasy is a prasad, a gift of a god. You just try, practice what Buddha says. At least 1 hour you become a non-doer. At least for 1 hour in deep in the night, sit alone. Don't do anything, not even chanting a mantra, not even transcendental meditation. Don't do anything. Just sit. Lie down. Look at the stars. That too should not be harsh. Look very softly. Don't focus. Remain unfocused, like an unfocused photograph, hazy, blurred, not knowing where are the boundaries. Just remain silent in the darkness. If thoughts come, let them come. Don't fight with them either. They will come and they will go. You just be a watcher. It is none of your business whether they come or they go. Who are you? They come without invitation, they go without pushing. They come and go. It is a constant traffic. You just sit by the side of the road and watch. Just be lazy and see what happens. You will be amazed. Someday, just sitting, not doing anything. Someday, from some unknown source, a lightning, a benediction. Someday in some moment, suddenly you are transfigured. Suddenly you see a quiet descending upon you. It is almost physical. If a real meditator, a person who can relax, sits silently and allows, even somebody who is not a meditator will feel the presence that something is happening. May not be able to figure it out, what it is. May feel strange or a little scared. But if you sit by the side of a meditator, now it is difficult to use the right word, because the meditator again gives the impression as if he is doing something, doing meditation. Remember, again and again, language has been developed by non-meditators. So the whole language is in a subtle way wrong. It cannot express. When somebody is sitting there, just sitting there, like a tree, like a rock, not doing anything, it happens. Something from the above descends, penetrates his very core of being. A subtle light surrounds him, a glow, a blessing can be felt around him. Even by those people who don't know what meditation is, even passing by the side, they will also feel the impact of it. This benediction has been called God. God is not a person. It is a deep experience when you are not doing anything and existence simply flows in you. The immensity of it, the beatitude of it, the grace of it. You are not doing anything. You are not even expecting anything. You are not waiting for anything. You have no motive. You are just there, like a tree standing in the winds, or like a rock, just silently sitting by the side of a river. Are like a cloud perched on the hilltop. Just there. No movement of your own. In that moment you are not a self.
In that moment you are in no self. In that moment you are not a mind, you are in no mind. In that moment you don't have a center. In that moment you are immense vastness with no boundaries. Suddenly the contact. Suddenly it is there. Suddenly you are fulfilled. Suddenly you are surrounded by some unknown presence. It is tremendous. That's what Buddha says. Practice the deed that is not doing. To speak the speech that is inexpressible. And if you want to say something, say that which cannot be said. Express the inexpressible. What is the point of saying things which can be said? Anybody knows them. Everybody knows them. If you really want to express something, express the inexpressible. What is the way to express the inexpressible? It can be expressed only through being. Words are too narrow. It can be expressed only by your existence, by your presence. In your walking, in your sitting, in your eyes, in your gestures, in your touch. In your compassion, in your love, the way you are, it can be expressed through it. Buddha talks, but that is not very essential. More essential is his being, that he is there. Through his talking, he allows you to be with him. The talking is just persuading you. Because it will be difficult for you to be in silence with a Buddha. He has to talk. Because if he is talking, you feel that everything is okay. You can listen. If he is not talking, how you will listen? You don't know how to listen when nobody is talking. You don't know how to listen that which cannot be expressed. But by and by, living around a master, a Buddha, a Jesus, by and by you will start imbibing his spirit. By and by, in spite of you, there will be moments when you will relax. And not only that which he is saying will be reaching into your heart, but that which he is also will penetrate. And with him, the whole dimension of happening opens. That's the meaning of satsanga, being in the presence of a master. Trained and to be trained in the discipline that is beyond discipline. And Buddha says there is a discipline which is not a discipline. Ordinarily we think about discipline as if somebody else is trying to discipline you. Discipline carries a very ugly connotation. As if you are being disciplined. As if you are just to obey. And the center that is disciplining you is outside you. Buddha says that is not discipline, that is surrendering to slavery. Be free. No need to be disciplined from any outside source. Become alert so that inner discipline arises in you. Become responsible. So that whatsoever you do with a certain order, a certain cosmos in it. So that your being is not a chaos. So that your being is not in a mess. So there are two types of discipline. One that can be forced from the outside. That's what politicians go on doing. Priests go on doing. Parents go on doing, and there is a discipline that can be provoked in you, that can be done only by masters. They don't enforce any discipline on you, they make you simply more aware, so you can find your own discipline. People come to me and they ask, why don't you give us certain discipline? What to eat, what not to eat, when to get up in the morning and when to go to bed. I don't give you any such discipline. Because any discipline that comes from outside is destructive.
I give you only one discipline, what Buddha calls the discipline of the beyond, the discipline of transcendence. I give you only one discipline, and that is of being aware. If you are aware, you will get up in the right time. When the body is rested, you will get up. When you are aware, you will eat only that which is needed. You will eat only that which is the least harmful to you and to others. You will eat only that which is not based on violence. But awareness will be the decisive factor. Otherwise, you can be forced to become obedient, but deep down you go on being rebellious. I have heard a Second World War story. A sergeant and a private were up on a charge of kicking the colonel. When asked for an explanation, the sergeant replied, "Well, sir, the colonel came round the corner as I was coming from the gym. I only had my plimsolls on. He was in riding boots and he trod on my toe. I'm afraid the pain was so great, sir, that I lashed out, and before I realized who it was, sir." "I see," said the orderly officer. "And what about you, soldier?" To which the private replied, "I saw the sergeant kick the colonel, sir, so I thought to myself, the war must be over, so I can also kick." Whenever somebody enforces a discipline on you, deep down you resent. Deep down you are against it. You may surrender to it, but you surrender always reluctantly, and that's how it should be. Because the deepest urge in a human being is for freedom, for moksha. To be free is the search down the centuries, millennia. In many lives we have been searching how to be free. So whenever somebody comes, even for your own sake, for your own good, and forces something upon you, you resist. It is against human nature. It is against human destiny. Buddha says there is no need to be obedient to somebody else. You should find your own awareness. Be obedient to it. Be aware. That is the only scripture. Be aware. That is the only master. Be aware, and nothing can ever go wrong. Awareness brings its own discipline, like a shadow. And then the discipline is beautiful. Then it is not like a slavery. Then it is like a harmony. Then it is not like enforced. Then it is a flowering out of your own being, a blooming. And to be trained in the discipline that is beyond discipline. People ordinarily seek somebody to tell them what to do because they are afraid of their freedom. Because they don't know that they can rely on their own sources. Because they are not self-confident. Because they have been always told by somebody else to do. So they have become addicted to it. They are searching father figures their whole life. Their God is also a father, nothing else. That God is false, which is a father. And the search for a father figure is anti-life. You should learn how to be free from all father figures. You should learn how to be yourself. You should learn how to be aware and responsible. Then only you start growing. Maturity is always maturity towards freedom. Immaturity is always a sort of dependence and a fear of freedom. A child is dependent, it's okay, it can be understood. He is helpless.
But why remain a child your whole life? That is the revolution Buddha brought into the world. He is one of the most rebellious thinkers of the world. He throws you to yourself. It is dangerous, but he takes that risk. And he says everybody has to take that risk. There is every possibility you may go astray, but life is risk. It is better to go astray on your own accord than to reach heaven following somebody else. It is better to be lost forever and be yourself than to reach paradise as a carbon copy, as an imitator. Then your paradise will be nothing but a prison. And if you have chosen your own hell on your own accord, out of your own freedom, your hell will also be heaven, because freedom is heaven. Now here you will see the difference between Christianity and Buddhism. Christianity says Adam was expelled because he disobeyed God. Buddha says, obey only yourself. There is no other God to be obeyed. Christianity calls disobedience the original sin, and Buddha calls obedience the original sin. Tremendous is the difference. Buddha is a liberator. Christianity created an imprisonment for whole humanity. Buddha's liberation is pure. He teaches you rebellion, but his rebellion is not a political rebellion. He teaches you rebellion with responsibility, with awareness. His rebellion is not a reaction. You can be obedient, you can be disobedient. What Buddha is saying, neither be obedient nor be disobedient, because disobedience is again being conditioned by somebody else. You go on doing something because your father says, don't do it, but again he is manipulating you in a negative way. You go on doing something because the society says, don't do it, but again the society is determining what you should do. Buddha says rebellion is not reaction. It is neither slavery nor reaction, neither obedience nor disobedience. It is an inner discipline. It is a discipline. It is a tremendous order, but it comes from your inner core. You decide it. We go on throwing our responsibility on others. It is easier. You can always say that your father said to do it, so you have done. You are not responsible. You can always say the leader said to do it, so you have done. You are not responsible. The whole country was going to do it, was going in a war and killing other country. You have done it because you simply obeyed. When Adolf Hitler's colleagues were caught after the Second World War, they all confessed before the court that they are not responsible. They were simply obeying orders. Whatever order was given, they were obeying. If the order was given, kill 1 million Jews, they killed. They were simply following orders. They were simply obedient. They are not responsible. Now look and watch. You may be simply trying to find out someone who says do this so you can throw the responsibility on him. But this is no way to throw the responsibility on anybody else. Life is yours and responsibility is yours. If you understand Buddha, the world will be totally different. There cannot be then any more Hitlers, and there cannot be then any more wars, because there cannot be any obedience from the outside. And everybody responsible will think on his own. Not that Hindus are killing Mohammedans, so I have to kill. Or Mohammedans are burning temples, so I have to burn because I am a Mohammedan. Each individual should become a light unto himself. And he should decide, not as a Mohammedan, not as a Christian, not as an Indian, not as a Pakistani. He should decide according to his own consciousness. not according to anything else. This is what Buddha calls the discipline that is beyond discipline. This is the definition of a religious person. He thinks the thought that is unthinkable. He practices the deed that is not doing. He speaks that which is inexpressible, ineffable, and he practices the discipline that is beyond discipline. Those who understand this are near. Those who are confused are far. If these four things are understood, you are close to truth. If you don't understand them, you are far away from the truth. The way is beyond words and expressions, is bound by nothing earthly. Lose sight of it to an inch, or miss it for a moment, and we are away from it forevermore. Those who understand it are close. Now let this be a criterion for you, you can judge. Let this be a touchstone for your growth. If you feel these four things are happening in your life, in howsoever quantity, maybe very small quantity, but if they are happening, then you are on the right track. If you are going away from these four things, you are going away from the way, the Dhamma, the Tao. The way is beyond words and expressions, is bound by nothing earthly. The ultimate truth is not bound by anything that you can see, that you can touch. It is not dependent on your senses. The ultimate truth is not material. It is immaterial. It is not earthly. It cannot be caused by anything. That's why it can never become part of science. You can mix hydrogen and oxygen and you can cause water to be there. There is no way to create ecstasy that way. There is no way to cause God that way. There is no way to cause truth that way. You can destroy water by separating hydrogen and oxygen. You can create water by mixing hydrogen and oxygen. But there is no way to destroy truth or to cause it. It is uncaused. It is not a chain of cause and effect. You cannot create it. It is already there. You cannot destroy it because you are it. It is the very life. You can only do one thing. Either you can close your eyes towards it. Either you can forget about it. You can become absolutely oblivious of it. Or you can remember, see, realize. If you are lost in too much doing, ambition, riches, money, prestige, power, then you will lose track of the truth, which is always by the side of you, just by the corner, just within reach, but you are keeping your back towards it. Or you can allow it. If you become a little more meditative and less ambitious, if you become a little more religious and less political, if you become a little more unworldly than worldly, if you start moving more within words than without, if you start becoming a little more alert than sleepy, if you come out of your drunk state, if you bring a little light into your being, then you will be close, close home. You have never been away. Then your whole life will be transformed, transfigured. Then you will live in a totally different way. A new quality will be there in your life, which has nothing to do with your doing, which is a gift, a benediction. Lose sight of it to an inch, says Buddha, or miss it for a moment, and we are away from it
forevermore. Look into it for a single moment. Come close to it even a single inch, and it is yours, and it has been always yours. This is the paradox of a Siddhanta. This is not a doctrine. This is Buddha's realization. He is simply trying to share his realization with you. He is not propounding a philosophy or a system of thought. He is simply pointing towards the moon, the reality. Don't look at his pointing fingers, otherwise you will miss. You will become a Buddhist. Look at the moon, the finger is pointing. Forget the finger completely and look at the moon and you will become a Buddha. This is the problem that humanity has to settle. It is very easy to become a Christian than to become a Christ. Very easy to become a Buddhist than to become a Buddha. But the reality is known only by becoming a Christ or a Buddha. By becoming a Christian or a Buddhist, you are again becoming carbon copies. Don't insult yourself that way. Have a little respect for yourself. Never be a Christian and never be a Buddhist and never be a Hindu. Just be consciousness, undefined, unbound, unmotivated. If you can do that much, all else will follow on its own accord. Enough for today.